its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. We're glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. Reach us anytime via email at currentstate@wkar.org. Your segment ideas, your feedback is always welcome. Later this hour, we explore one issue that you can say faces American education on all levels. All of it is, of course, associated with funding. And this afternoon, downtown Lansing at the Michigan Municipal League, Michigan State University is hosting some esteemed guests who have all kinds of different perspectives on how to enhance and improve our approaches to funding education in this country. We're going to talk with two key participants in that conference later this hour. One of them, Michigan State University's Robert Floden, head of the Center for Education Policy here in East Lansing. And we also, it's quite a strong nature show today. We go bird watching in Meridian Township later in the hour, and there's a group of Okemos students who are lobbying for a state amphibian for the state of Michigan. So we get a little creepy crawly here before the hour is over as well. To start out our program today, for 14 years, Eric Schertzing has served as Ingham County Treasurer, and about 6 weeks or so ago, he began charting a new path representing Michigan's 8th Congressional District, which includes Lansing and East Lansing. For now, Schertzing is one of four Democrats who've announced for their party's nomination this August. Four Republicans are also in the race. To hear how the effort is going, to learn more about the candidate, we welcome Eric Schertzing back to Current State.
Thank you, Mark.
Welcome.
Great to be with you.
It's good to see you. The Lansing City Pulse wrote of your, quote, middle of the road, unquote, approach to politics. And you admitted to them, quote, there's not as much black and white as some people would like. There's a lot of gray. Talk to us about that gray. Why do you describe yourself this way?
Well, you know, I think what folks are looking for from government is to get things done. And if you spend all your time on the extremes or the black and whites and can't get yourself to the middle, you're just not getting done for the citizenry, the work that they expect. I work hard to bring all sides together and move us forward to improve the community.
Will that be at the heart of your message to voters heading closer to August?
Well, you know, we're still working on that. This is a big district. You know, I'm running for the 8th Congressional District. I've been honored to serve as Ingham County Treasurer for 14 years, and before that for Pat Lindeman in the Drain Office. But this is a federal race. This is for a congressional district that's all of Ingham, all of Livingston County, and the northern two tiers of townships in Oakland, including a little reach down to Rochester Hills for people that know the, you know, geography through Clarkston and Lake Orion in Oakland County. So, you know, it's a big area, and I do believe in trying to represent the area that you serve.
Do you think you might how do you think that message will unfold, though? I mean, do you figure that you may enhance that? Yeah, problem solving seems to be at the heart of what you're saying. You consider yourself a problem solver.
Well, you know, a problem solver, we did that as county treasurer working on tax and mortgage foreclosure prevention. We did that in the Tri-County area, won, you know, a national award for the quality of that outreach effort. It's part of setting up the Land Bank Authority, which is, you know, working on housing issues and unloved properties, making them better. Job creation comes out of that. You know, I think folks in the 8th District are looking for jobs and for stability for the middle class. And we've had a long time slide in the earnings of the middle class in this country. We've got to work together, not be at loggerheads in Washington all the time, to do the work for all of the people, not just some of the special interest.
Connect those dots, though, for us. How does the land bank activity lead to job creation?
Well, you know, we were able to do a lot of renovation and new home construction. Land Policy Institute at Michigan State University did a study of our activity and, you know, proved that we created hundreds of jobs and generated significant tax revenue. Quality housing is necessary for jobs. People deserve it. It leads to more wealth in the community, and wealth leads to jobs.
Talk to us about the trajectory of the next few months. What kinds of activities are you concentrating right now on, and how will those be changing as you move closer to August?
Well, I'm working with the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and putting together a professional team. The campaign manager, who was a deputy field director for Elizabeth Warren in 2012 in Massachusetts, started recently. I've got a call time manager. You know, a lot of this is
more
about
job creation.
More job creation,
absolutely.
And you know, a lot of the stuff for the next couple months is raising money so that you have the resources for the primary and the general election.
When you visited with WKAR's Kevin Lavery a month or so ago, you referred to all the discussions that you were having. And this is a big if. If you're successful in August, are you thinking that the state and national party organizations are going to get behind you sufficiently to really make it a contest in this GOP-leaning district? It is 54% apparently Republican.
I think that's probably a little bit high. But yes, I do. I mean, we have two competitive congressional districts in Michigan that are recognized by both of the parties, the first and the seventh. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee sees me as the opportunity to make the 8th district the third competitive district in Michigan. The base that I have in Ingham County, and Ingham County is key to winning the 8th district. In the last election, I got 67% of the vote. The election before that, 65. You know, we need performance, Dem performance, in that mid-60 range to turn this seat Democratic. I've got the history of representing the area. People know me and the hard work and the ethics, the work ethic that I bring to the job, and I think they'll look forward to that in the U.S. Congress.
What makes Ingham County the key to winning the 8th? I mean,
well, because we have good Democratic performance here, and it's going to be a target area for voter turnout for the Gary Peters Senate campaign and Mark Schauer's gubernatorial race. So we're going to have all three campaigns, the U.S. Senate, the gubernatorial, and the congressional, focusing efforts on Ingham County for voter turnout. And with that turnout comes good vote performance for Democratic candidates.
But your conversations with the party are encouraging to you at this point?
Absolutely. This is a winnable seat when it's open. The president carried it in 8. Stabenow carried it in 12. You know, as an open seat, we have a lot of competitive stuff going on here in Michigan. I think Michigan is going to be a significant battleground area for Democrats.
You certainly have a longer record of high-profile public service than your primary competitors. Are you confident about winning the primary?
Well, you know, we're not going to take it for granted, and we're certainly going to watch it and be mindful. But, you know, this is a lot of work. It takes a lot of, you know, effort. I've been working on this for 32 years. We have four wonderful candidates. I met and know the three other candidates in the race. I think trying to approach your first elective office as the U.S. Congress is going to be quite a challenge. I think my history here and my vote performance here is going to carry us through the primary.
We're talking with Ingham County Treasurer Eric Schurting, one of four Democrats who have announced their candidacy for the Michigan's 8th Congressional District, which represents Lansing and East Lansing. Who do you expect the GOP to put up?
Well, you know, they've got two candidates, one that's a Tea Party state rep and the other one that is reported as having said he was Tea Party before the Tea Party was cool. I think some of your listeners this morning would probably be scratching their head over exactly what that means for the Tea Party to have
that's
been
Mike
cool.
Bishop.
That's Mr. Bishop.
Yeah. Have you set a fundraising goal? I mean, in general, talk to us about fundraising. How is that going?
Well, you know, it's going well. We're getting better at it every day. I've got a call person that works with me. That's where I'm headed from here to do phone calls for the day. It's unfortunate that is as big a part of the access to democracy and elective office as it is, but that is where we are. I'm confident that we're going to have the resources we need to run a first-class campaign. And, what happens after the primary is dependent upon what's going on everywhere in the state of Michigan and across the country. Resources move around. But I think that the history that I've got here in Ingham County, working hard, serving the public, is going to do us well and prove to folks that this is a winnable district.
You looked at this seat a year or so ago when Mike Rogers was considering the Senate. He ended up dropping that bid. But lo and behold, on March 28th, not that long ago, he announced he was dropping out. I have to ask you what did you think? What was going through your mind when you heard that? And were you expecting anything like that?
Was not expecting that. We certainly had looked at the seat with others. I got a text at 8 a.m. from somebody. You running?
Was that how you found out?
Yeah. I was sitting in a meeting in a room in a basement without good cell reception.
And you found out Mike Rogers was not running for re-election by someone's text that said, "You running?" Question mark.
Question mark. Yeah. Things sometimes just fit in life. I started out working for Congressman Carr when he was out of office after the 1980,
right.
Reagan Revolution, when I was a sophomore in college. So, a congressional experience has always been in mind on stuff. I'm in between elections for the county treasurer. My oldest daughter has graduated from high school and is going off to Kalamazoo College in the fall. The twins are going into junior year of high school. My wife was on board. You need all of these different things to line up to be able to take advantage of opportunities like this. And so the opportunity presented itself. Other candidates were looking at it. From April 4th to the 13th, we were in Mexico City seeing my oldest daughter. She had graduated a year early from East Lansing High School and was doing a Rotary Youth Exchange experience for a year. Hadn't seen her since April 15th. So in the middle of all this, I wasn't going to pass up on seeing my oldest daughter and the family vacation in Mexico. So, we're making arrangements and trying to figure out how this is all going to happen. And while we were away, the decision was made to go forward. We scrambled in that 10 days when we got back to get all the petition signatures put together, and we filed those April 22nd. And we've just been building the team to put together a first-class, winnable 8th Congressional District operation since.
Plenty of Democratic candidates are being asked about their take on the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. Were you a supporter of the Affordable Care Act? And would you be open to alterations in the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I grew up on a farm down in the Stockbridge area, and the way I was raised is your word is your bond. So we've been fighting over keep it versus throw it out. I think the American public wants it fixed. If we told folks, which we did, that you can keep your plan or keep your doctor, that's what we should be fighting for. You should keep your word when you make it. That's part of the problem in Washington. That's part of the dysfunction down there, is folks have forgotten that key value of representing the citizens. You keep your word when you make it.
But would you be open to alterations?
Absolutely. You should fix things. Legislation is never perfect when you pass it, especially complicated legislation. So, yes, we should be in there fighting for fixes. The other side has been all about repeal, or for a long, long time they were about repeal, and that accomplished nothing for the American people.
Are there other national issues that you've begun to think about? Getting involved in the national stage requires a greater acquaintance with those. It would obviously be some kind of period of transition for you, but there must be other national issues that you feel strongly about.
Well, it is a little bit different than being the Ingham County Treasurer, Mark. the questions change. We've got things like there should be equal pay for equal work. I mean, that's an important issue to me. The minimum wage is something that we've got to deal with getting that raised, making sure Social Security is protected. For a lot of time, that's been under attack. And I think that is the foundation for a secure retirement with dignity for individuals.
You've talked about infrastructure, too.
Yeah, well, you know, that's another one. And when I worked with Congressman Carr, he was on the Appropriations Committee, Transportation Subcommittee. So we brought a lot of resources back to improve the roads in Michigan in the 80s. And frankly, they've been falling apart since. You know, roads and bridges and infrastructure, water and sewage, those were never partisan issues. You know, what have we come to when rebuilding our roads and bridges becomes a partisan issue? I just don't understand that, and we need to change that. The other part of infrastructure, though, is also on the human side. You know, education and job training experiences need to be affordable. We can't have our youth leaving college with debt equivalent to a mortgage. When they leave college with debt loads like that, they're not buying houses and they're not buying cars. That's part of the erosion of the middle class in this country.
What do you consider the biggest problem you've solved in your public career so far?
You know, I think it is really rebuilding communities through housing. We've done that as county treasurer by minimizing the negative impact of tax and mortgage foreclosure and making sure that counseling opportunities are available to keep families in their homes. And we've done it through the land bank, through blight removal, you know, homes that can't be saved, and then also renovating or building new homes. The greatest thing I get to do as land bank chair is go to closings with, you know, families, often it's a single mom, and turn over the keys to a house so that they can realize the American dream. I think of a woman in Mason that had been trying to own a house for years. She has two special needs children. She had almost given up. And through the land bank efforts, we were able to put her in a home, a stable home, a new home, an energy efficient home for her and her two children.
Eric Schertzing is the Ingham County Treasurer and the Chairman of the Ingham County Land Bank. He is one of four Democratic candidates for Michigan's 8th Congressional District. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Talk again soon.
Thanks, Mark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Some elementary students in Okemos are wrapping up their school year with a crash course in political lobbying. Four students at the Okemos Public Montessori at Central Elementary have written to State Representative Sam Singh asking him to sponsor a bill designating the Northern Spring Peeper as Michigan's state amphibian. The kids do have some competition, though, and here to explain is Current State's Kevin Lavery. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Mark. There are actually three bills circulating right now in the Michigan House, each for a different species of frog. The Northern Spring Peeper is the choice here in mid-Michigan. However, as it turns out, last year, State Representative Pat Somerville introduced a bill that supports the Eastern Gray Tree Frog, and State Rep Matt Laurie is backing the Blanchard's Cricket Frog. So I paid a visit to Central Elementary to find out how the Okemos students got involved, and I found fourth grade teacher Christine Batora. She goes by Mrs. Christine, and she was giving a lesson on our state symbols when the kids were chagrined to learn that Michigan lacks a state amphibian.
I told them that no one had proposed that yet and blew it off, and they quickly wanted to follow up on that, so they contacted their parents, and their parents asked them to come back to me and talk to our state representative, Representative Singh, and I brought it back to the students and said, well, I'm not going to do much about this other than give it back to you, and they said, we're on it. And so three of our awesome fourth grade students decided to write a position letter, actually a persuasive position letter, to Representative Singh giving us facts of the spring peeper because they had decided as a class that that was the best choice. They wrote the letter and we sent it to Representative Singh's aide, who then quickly told us that the same week Representative Laurie had proposed a bill for another state amphibian, which even drove our passion for the spring peeper even further because we were shocked to hear that another school had the same idea. And these girls have made it their mission, and thus our school's mission and Okemos' mission, to dedicate the spring peeper as our focus for the state amphibian.
Mrs. Christine gave a great overview. Now it was time to consult the real experts, the team of young ladies who leaped into action. Morgan Jameson, Lauren Hutnick, Audrey Hertrude Walton, and Mia Chen, each one a true champion of the underfrog.
Why the northern spring peeper?
This is Lauren. Well, it's been a really harsh winter, so we wanted to have a welcome to spring.
But why that particular frog?
Because it's called the spring peeper.
Of course. Why didn't I think of that?
And it welcomes spring with its sounds.
Now, you've got some competition. There's a couple other frogs out there. Someone else is asking for the eastern gray tree frog, and somebody else is asking for the Blanchard's cricket frog. So what makes the northern spring peeper the best one?
This is Mia. The northern spring peeper is the most common of Michigan's singing frogs. The Blanchard's cricket frog might become extinct. It's threatened. And the spring peeper is very common, so if kids could find the spring peeper in their backyard, they'd be more educated and more excited about their state amphibian than if they couldn't find one anywhere.
Very good. How did you guys first start researching this and learning about this and taking up the cause of the frog?
This is Audrey. Well, Ms. Christine showed us a website of all of Michigan's like amphibians and animals, and so we all decided as a class that would be like the most like easy to persuade, and we'd all think that this is because it is the best for Michigan.
So here's the letter that you wrote to State Representative Sam Singh.
Dear Representative Singh, we request that the northern spring peeper be identified as Michigan state amphibian.
When you think of this freezing, cold, polar vortex in Michigan, wouldn't you like a cheery welcome to spring? Yes, of course you would. If we made the northern spring peeper the state amphibian, we would have a beautiful sleigh song to welcome spring. Since spring peepers survive the winter by freezing when spring begins, they joyfully greet the new season and opportunity to come alive again with their happy song. Female spring peepers lay 750 to 1,200 eggs, which means more peeps and peepers for all of us. They are helpful to our environment by eating spiders, mites, ticks, pill bugs, caterpillars, and ants, and most importantly, mosquitoes.
Michiganders enjoy knowing that our state symbols are in our backyard. The Michigan Department of Natural Resources website states, "The spring peepers are to the amphibian world what robins are to the bird world. The spring peeper is the most abundant of Michigan's singing frogs and is common statewide. Because the spring peeper is very common in Michigan, kids can identify them in their backyards near ponds and swamps. Our fellow classmates have all heard and seen these unique creatures. Spring peepers are easily identifiable by the brown X pattern on their back."
Making the spring peeper our state amphibian will bring attention to conserving our Michigan environment. With the spring peeper as our state amphibian, Michiganders will work harder to keep our water clean, since polluted waters will harm them. The Michigan Department of Natural Resources website states that, "It is our responsibility to make sure that we will always be able to open a window on a warm spring night and fall asleep to the tinkle of the spring peeper. We pledge to help keep our water clean and protect these incredible amphibians."
Girls, that's one of the best letters I've ever heard in my life. How long did it take to write that?
About 45 minutes.
45 minutes to get those thoughts together?
Yeah.
Did you guys ever think that in the fourth grade you would learn how to be a lobbyist?
No, not really.
But we do know what it means now that we're actually lobbyists ourselves.
Well, you have to meet a lot of people, and you have to persuade them to vote for the spring peeper.
You have to be really good at persuading people to think that your thing that you're campaigning for is better than all the others.
So I take it then you guys have learned here in the fourth grade how to write a persuasive letter. So you've put your skills to the test already then.
Yeah, Miss Christine has taught us almost everything about writing, and so, yeah, she is my favorite teacher.
It's a good thing this is radio, because Miss Christine is in the background blushing right now. So it sounds like, Miss Christine, that your students are getting an environmental activism lesson, persuasive letter writing, civics 101. This has been quite a course for them.
It has, and I'm just really fortunate to have students who love to learn and who are excited
with any endeavor that they're presented, and they're just really excited about learning in general. They just really are. And any opportunity to share about something they're excited about learning about, they run to books, they run to people, they run to each other. And it's really exciting for me as a teacher to have the opportunity to have students who just love to learn. And they really are teaching me what learning truly is.
Mrs. Christine's class learned something else, too, that being the voice of the Northern Spring Peeper is not the same as sounding like it.
Well, it's the sound of sleigh bells, so I don't know how to do that.
But Lauren gave it a try anyway. Pretty close. Here's the real thing. Now the students are putting up posters and a Facebook site to spur on the vote for the Northern Spring Peeper, and they want other schools across the state to join them, including Michigan State University.
It would be great if MSU could continue to support us. We have a lot of professors at MSU backing us or supporting us for the Northern Spring Peeper for state amphibian. And so we really hope MSU will also get on board celebrating this great drive for learning and for environmental teaching. So we're hoping Michigan will continue to support us.
Well, if MSU can have Kermit the Frog as a grand marshal in a parade, maybe the Northern Spring Peeper is the next step, right?
Exactly.
So now three bills have been filed in the Michigan House, one for each aspiring state amphibian. The House may take up the bills as early as this fall. Whoever wins, be it the Northern Spring Peeper, the Eastern Gray Tree Frog, or Blanchard's Cricket Frog, Michigan's next singing frog will have some huge web shoes to fill. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
It's not easy being green, having to spend each day the color of the leaves. When I think it could be nicer being red or yellow or gold or something much more colorful like that.
It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. Among all the issues facing American education, school choice, assessments, chronically low-performing schools, and others, funding closely impacts all of them. This afternoon in downtown Lansing, Michigan State University's Center for Education Policy is holding a conference featuring three notable education experts, each of whom will bring his own perspective to the country's education funding challenges. Yesterday, I spoke with two participants. Paul Revel is a professor of educational policy and administration at Harvard University and was Massachusetts Secretary of Education when the state became the best in the nation in various educational measurements. And Dr. Robert Floden is an organizer of today's gathering. He serves as co-director of MSU's Center for Education Policy. I first asked Robert Floden about the larger aim of today's conference.
Sure. So it's about 20 years since Michigan changed the way it financed schools with Proposition A. And various issues have been coming up, particularly as we've also gotten into schools of choice and charter schools. And now people are interested in thinking about how we might use the funds we're using in schooling differently. So the State Board of Education, the governor, have both been thinking about this. So I thought, with the encouragement of some people in the government, that it would be helpful to bring in a few outside experts to bring in some other ideas.
And I understand one angle you won't be covering is how the ed sector might get a bigger allotment in state funding next year compared to this year. It's really not about that.
I don't think so. I don't think that would be a productive discussion in this group.
Paul Revel, you're one of the three guest speakers this afternoon. You'll be talking about what's labeled the Massachusetts model. What is the Massachusetts model and how does it work?
Well, I think the Massachusetts model simply refers to the fact that we've been highly successful with our efforts in education reform since 1993. And those have been a combination of a commitment to high standards, real accountability, and a commitment on behalf of governors of both parties and legislatures with all kinds of different leaders to provide adequate resources to build the capacity in the education system to achieve at higher levels than ever before.
And you've got data you can point to here, high graduation levels and so forth?
We've got a lot of data that would suggest that Massachusetts is at or near the top on virtually any indicator you want to bring forward in terms of student achievement in the United States. And yet I got to say right away that we're not, we neither do we have all the answers, nor have we achieved our original goals when we set out to do education reform. There's a lot more that needs to be done. But on the national report card, the NAEP, we are first in the nation in English and math at fourth and eighth grade. And we've done that five consecutive times. No other state has done it once. We've done it five times in a row now over a 10-year period. On international measures, we're at or near the top. We've basically moved out of the middle of the pack in student achievement during our reform efforts to now first in the nation. But it's not good enough, and we have a long way to go. And we've done some things that have helped us get there. And I'd be happy to talk at the conference about those things. And yet we have more that needs to be done.
What are some of the lessons that you think might be in the Massachusetts model for other states, for Michigan, for example?
Well, I think we had very strong business leadership in this effort because the success of the education system was perceived to be integrally important to the success of the economy in Massachusetts. So there was a deep-seated belief and strong advocacy on behalf of the business community that pushed the public sector and the field of education in particular, but the legislative leadership and the governor and so forth, to prioritize education as an economic development strategy. And so that was very important. Setting high standards. We set the nation's highest standards in Massachusetts and having real accountability associated with it. So we have both high standards and high stakes in our education system. A lot of states had high standards but low stakes. Some states had high stakes but low standards. We did both.
Sounds like it's a lot about consensus building.
Well, there was a lot of doing reform with the field rather than to the field, and that was part of the success that we had, that we're a highly unionized state the way Michigan is. And while we didn't agree and have consensus on everything, we had widespread agreement on important things to do, and there were key bargains. The whole of education reform in Massachusetts was entitled or labeled at various points a grand bargain, which meant that really it was a bargain between the field, who agreed to accept stringent measures of accountability in exchange for a refinancing of the system that had been starved for finance due to various kinds of economic setbacks in education.
I assume it must have some critics. What do critics of the Massachusetts model say? Is there a feature of the Massachusetts model that you wish worked better?
Well, those are two separate questions. We have critics there are critics everywhere on matters of public policy or on standards-based reform generally. So we have some people who quibble about the standards. There's some people who feel there's been too much testing. There's some people who don't like school choice or charter schools. So there are various critics of various aspects of the strategies. I think what we've done on the whole has been necessary but not sufficient. And as I look to the future, I think we need to focus on some key strategies like differentiating between our students and giving each student what he or she needs rather than a one-size-fits-all model. I think we need to do a better job of bringing our health and social services systems into closer integration and collaboration with public schools so as to eliminate the impediments that get in the way of young people attending school or being attentive and supplying motivated effort when they get there. Third thing is I think we need to be much more attentive to closing the opportunity gap in the 80% of children's waking hours that are spent outside of school when affluent children have ready access to all kinds of learning opportunities, whether it's music lessons or travel or summer camps or early childhood education. And low-income disadvantaged youngsters don't have those advantages. And it turns out those comparative advantages and disadvantages have every bit as much to do with achievement gaps as anything that happens in school. So I think one of the lessons we've learned in Massachusetts is that schools alone, at least as conceived in the early 20th century model that we've inherited today, are insufficient to doing the job of educating all of our students to a high standard. And that's important because educating all of our students to a high standard is what it's going to take to get this economy up and going, because those are the kinds of jobs, 21st century high-skill, high-knowledge jobs, that are going to fuel the American economy in the future.
It's Current State on WKAR, discussing issues in education funding with Harvard Professor of Educational Policy and Administration and former Massachusetts State Secretary of Education Paul Revel, along with MSU Education Policy Center co-director Dr. Robert Floden. Bob Floden, Paul refers to a consensus that education and the economy are closely tied. You hear a lot of talk about that here in Michigan. Do you feel we have a growing consensus in that direction in our state?
I see a lot of similarities between Massachusetts and Michigan in this regard. And, with our reliance on the auto industry for many years, people have been saying that there's been a need for changes in education as the needs of the knowledge and skills of the workers has changed, from just being able to show up at the factory and do repetitive tasks to now being able to think, to work in groups, to think through things, to understand, to be able to read manuals and texts and work out problems with the more complex machinery. So I think there's a great deal of similarity between Massachusetts and Michigan in that regard. I don't think we've reached the same consensus about how it is that Michigan's education system is going to meet that challenge to the degree it's been reached in Massachusetts. We have been pushing for high standards. The Michigan Merit Curriculum that was put into place a few years ago was a major step at the secondary school level to raise the standards for all children in terms of what they needed to do to graduate from high school. And the changes that have been put in place in the testing system in Michigan to align those better with what we know about how test results relate to success in jobs and in college, those have been important things. But I don't think we've reached agreement on exactly what else we should be doing in the education system to move us ahead.
Bob, let's talk a bit about your two other guests. Larry Miller of the University of Washington will bring what to the conference?
He works for the Center for Reinventing Public Education, which is a think tank. The part of the think tank that he's been working in has been looking at the way in which education, K-12 education, is financed in five different states. Michigan is not one of them, but he has a range of states, including New York and California. And he's going to come and talk about the differences in the models for how the funds are allocated to support education, how that varies across states, and the some of the opportunities he sees for changing the way of in which funds are expended that would allow for school districts to make more productive use of the funds that they bring. So that's Larry Miller. Tom DeLuca has done work in Michigan directly, and now he's working in some other states as well, to look at the use of education funds, particularly the non-instructional services, and an issue that has come up in Michigan, which is the extent to which districts might get together to consolidate their work in some non-instructional services, say the business office or transportation. And he's done work that has found that consolidations in the business office in particular have been helpful in Michigan's districts in allowing them to make better use of their funds. But in some other areas, even like transportation, he hasn't seen the same sort of effect.
Is it fair to call Mr. Miller, is he a defender of the charter school concept?
He's a defender of a market approach to education, I would say.
Paul Revel, how have public school academies done in Massachusetts under the Massachusetts plan?
You mean charter schools?
Charter schools, yes.
We've got some of the best charter schools in the nation in Boston, so we have a disproportionately high share of high-performing charter schools that are operating, particularly in eastern Massachusetts, in Boston and some of the surrounding communities. We've had a strong regulatory oversight view of charter schools and have been, strict on quality issues in approving original charters and renewing charters. And charters are setting some good examples for public schools here. The competition has been healthy. It's still a relatively small percentage of students are served by charter schools, so I don't think charter schools are a silver bullet or the answer for the future in the sense of setting up a parallel system. But at the same time, in places like Boston, we've got some outstanding schools that have shown that we can do far better with populations that we've historically failed in mainstream schools.
Robert Floden, how hard is it for states to alter education funding policy?
It's very difficult. In Michigan, before the early 90s, when we made a change, we went for many years without altering the way in which we collected and distributed education funds. It was very much based on local property tax values. And frankly, I think people didn't think that a change was possible, even though we had highly unequal amounts of funding per pupil in different school districts. And then in 92, Debbie Stabenow and the governor at the time got together, and they put together a package that made for a dramatic change. Now, we haven't changed much since then, except for the growth in charter schools and in schools of choice. But the basic funding model has remained pretty stable since then. I do think people are now wondering about how well it's working across the wide range of school districts.
Should it be easier to alter education funding policy? Can it be easier, Bob?
I don't think it will ever be easy. It's a situation where you're going to have winners and losers, and you need to figure out how to build a coalition of different groups that would come together in search of the common good, knowing that some of them probably won't do as well under some changes in the policies as they are currently doing.
Current State, discussing issues in education funding with Harvard Professor of Educational Policy and Administration and former Massachusetts State Secretary of Education Paul Revel. We're also joined by MSU Education Policy Center co-director Dr. Robert Floden. Paul Revel, one of Michigan's biggest education debates recently has been over which statewide student assessment to use in the future. How is Massachusetts going forward regarding student assessments, and is that as eventful a discussion in Massachusetts as it has been in Michigan?
I suspect it's not as important a discussion here. We adopted the Common Core standards. Again, we had the highest standards in the nation, and a lot of the Common Core standards were built on our standards, so that's been relatively uncontroversial here. We're in the process of moving toward the PARC tests, and thus far we haven't seen any significant opposition to that. I think that those discussions they've gotten politicized in ways that I frankly think are a distraction from the more important topic of what we're doing to change strategy to improve our performance as an education system to increase student learning. In other words, all of our states had significant achievement gaps before adopting new higher standards. We've now adopted new higher standards, and adults love to argue about those standards, but we've adopted them for the most part. And the question is not how we measure performance or not what the standards are in particular, but what strategies are we going to use to close achievement gaps that already existed prior to the adoption of new standards and tests.
We want to thank both of our guests today. Both are participants in this afternoon's conference on education funding being held at the Michigan Municipal League in downtown Lansing from noon till 4:30. Paul Revel is a featured speaker who will talk about the Massachusetts model of education funding. Dr. Robert Floden is a co-director of Michigan State University's Center for Education Policy, which is organizing the conference. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, gentlemen. Pleasure
My pleasure.
To be with you.
M- May is an important month for bird watchers. Bird Watching in Our Parks is a series of walks presented by Meridian Township Parks and the Capital Area Audubon Society. The final walk of the season takes place Sunday at 8 a.m. at the Davis Foster Preserve on North Van Atta Road. Naturalist Clara Bratton will guide participants through the grassland area to spot characteristic birds of Midwest prairies. And WKAR's Peter Wharf met Clara Bratton yesterday at the Harris Nature Center to talk about Michigan bird watching.
The local Capital Area Audubon Society has teamed up with Meridian Township to provide some bird walks for people in the township. We've been doing it for years at Fenner Nature Center, and so we're expanding our range and going to do some here. We've already had two, and this one coming up this Sunday is our last one for the spring season.
What sorts of birds will you be looking for?
That's a unique site out at the Davis Foster Park. It's a restored prairie, was farmland, and they've planted a lot of prairie grasses out there. And so it has created the perfect habitat for some birds that are not normally seen in this area. They're not flashy, they're not colorful, they're little brown jobs, we call them. Yeah. If you don't see a little sparrow, you know, everybody says it's an LBJ.
Right.
They're hard to identify, and they're skulky, they down in the grasses. Yeah. So they're hard to see, but this time of the year they're coming in, staking out nesting territories, and the process of doing that is singing. That's their way of saying, this is mine. And so there's, I was out there last week, and there's three birds out there that you don't normally find breeding sites for. Henslow's sparrow is one. The grasshopper sparrow is another one. And we also heard the horned lark last week. So those three birds we're going to key in on and really try to get. And then other, you know, there's a lot of other birds there too, but those are the ones we're really looking for.
So we'll be listening for some of those birds, and I guess you have some portable examples.
Right.
Here on your smartphone, on your, some of these sounds.
This is the Henslow sparrow. It's a hiccup is the best way you can describe it.
Okay.
So when you're walking through tall grasses, and there's these little birds that like to hide in the grass, right, you're basically listening for a hiccup.
Okay. It is, yeah, like a hiccup, and you'll be taking those sounds along with you, so people will know what to listen for.
Yeah,
during the
bird walk. You don't do sounds in the field. Right. It's breeding season; they're setting up territories, and that can really mess up the birds if you're playing recordings in the field. Mm-hmm. So, we'll huddle around the cars when we first get there and play some of these calls for a couple of the birds that we're really looking for, so they have an idea, and then we'll go on from there.
Yeah, what are maybe some of the unusual birds that you might see? Maybe you're hoping for some rarities. Are there any types like that?
Actually, those are the rarities.
Okay.
We will see some other things. Migration season is wearing down now. Spring, April, May, June, primarily May, is the main migration period for the birds who wintered southern United States, Central America, South America, coming up through to select their nesting territory. And that big migration push is pretty much winding down now. So I think a lot of the migrants that go through, some of the warblers, which are beautiful colors, but I think a lot of them have already gone through, those who are not going to stay here and nest.
Birds that go to the south, these migratory birds, you said Central and South America. So these are vast distances they're covering. They come through Michigan. Where does some of them wind up going north?
Some of them, a few of them stay here. Some of them go up into the northern lower peninsula. Some of them continue on up into the upper peninsula and way up into Canada. They have a long trip.
I'm speaking with Clara Bratton, former naturalist at the Fenner Nature Center in Lansing. We are at the Harris Nature Center today in Meridian Township talking about a bird watching event taking place on Sunday
It's at Davis Foster Park, north of Grand River, on Van Adder Road in Meridian Township. What are some other places that you like to go in our area or around the state to spot birds and just enjoy the outdoors? There's so many places, but do you have some personal favorites?
There are so many places. In Meridian Township, there's Harris Nature Center, of course, Leg Park, which is just across the road. There is Lake Lansing North Park, and there is Black Woods. Any place there's woods, fields, is a good place to go. This last weekend, I was at Ottawa City, and there's a peninsula that goes out into the lake there. The birding was fantastic this last weekend up there.
Yeah, what sorts of things did you see?
Warblers.
Yeah.
All kinds of warblers, vireos, flycatchers all flying through. Black pole warbler. I hadn't seen one in a long time, so it was fun seeing them up there.
Yeah. What does that bird look like?
He's a black and white bird. But his pattern is, he has a black cap on him and black streaks on his body.
Yeah. Tell me about some of the other things you do as a part-time naturalist now, besides leading bird watching tours. What other sorts of things?
I'm really involved in an organization called Wild Ones.
Right.
And we have...
We spoke to you earlier on
yes.
Current State during
yes.
Neighbors in Action.
Yes, we were over there a couple weeks ago. And I'm trying to... And it keys in very nicely with birds, because if you don't have the habitat for all the animals around us, mm-hmm. we're losing them. The bird populations are decreasing significantly, as are amphibians, a lot of the other animals that we... reptiles that we really are part of our whole environment.
Yeah.
And a key to our environment, and insects. People tend to say they don't like insects. Of course, the mosquitoes are buzzing around us here, so.
Not biting too bad, though.
No, yeah. No, actually, see, I wore a long-sleeve shirt,
yeah,
I knew.
I wore dark colors, but short sleeves.
But the native plants are extremely important to reestablishing a healthy environment.
What are some of the most unusual or even favorite birds of yours to spot, where you kind of see one and go, gotcha?
Gotcha. Yeah. Some of the common ones are really kind of fun to see. Yeah. I love to see tufted titmice. I think they're just the cutest little bird. And in the springtime, the warbler is going through. There are so many different colors. A Blackburnian warbler. Yeah. When you get a Blackburnian warbler in the sun, he has an orangish red breast,
yeah.
and it just glows like he's on fire. So,
some of those subtle colors are really most interesting too. When the light hits a bird right and catches the feathers, what appears to be gray or brown has shades right. of green or orange in them.
Right. Yeah. An indigo bunting is one of the our local ones, and if you look in the book, he's a blue. And on days that are overcast or cloudy, he's gray, because blue is reflected light. It's the way the feathers are built to reflect the light. So unless the light is there, the blue doesn't show up. But when the sun is on him, he glows too.
Clara Bratton leads you on bird watching this Sunday. Again, tell us when and where that is.
It is at 8 o'clock at Davis Foster Park on Van Adder Road, north of Grand River. It's on the dirt part of Van Adder Road, so there's not a lot distinguishing there, but look at the sign on the east side of the road.
Clara Bratton is a naturalist working with the Harris Nature Center and Fenner Nature Center and throughout the Lansing area. Clara, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Oh, thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And that's our show for today. Coming up Friday on Current State, we'll explore the debate around net neutrality. And if you've ever wondered where in the heck is that monument to the designer of the Jefferson Nickel, we'll get the answer from author Jerome Polin, who's compiled a book about all the odd tourist destinations in Michigan. We'll also have live music from Lindsay Liu and Joshua Rilko. That and more tomorrow on WKAR's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day.